This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello, and welcome to this special edition of the Saxo Market Call podcast. We're bringing this to you today because we're out on holiday today. Lucky us in Denmark, we have a whole spate of little holidays here in the spring, but we wanted to bring some content, so we're recording this on Tuesday, May 11th, 2021, late in the afternoon in European time. We have some interesting set of circumstances. That's not the focus immediately on the day-to-day market action here, but of course, we're coming to you as we've seen a nervous market recently. We have the S&P down something like 50 points before the open. But the topic today, as indicated into the title of today's podcast, is sort of a look at the green transformation space, green transformation stocks, and trying to put those in the context of whether we're seeing a more profound market rotation into value versus growth, just sort of taking stocks. And I think towards the end of the podcast, we'll probably have a little discussion, Peter, on maybe some echoes and the way a previous cycle that has some echoes of what's going on now, if that is set to continue. But you focused on this in a couple of podcasts recently, on our daily podcast, the fact that we've seen quite a drawdown in what we've called bubble stocks. And I guess this green transformation is not necessarily bubble stocks. I guess there could be some overlap there. But the performance there relative to the broader market, I mean, we've seen really aggressive rollover in some of these more speculative sectors. What's your perspective? What's going on here and how much this is going to continue?
Exactly. So we had a crazy year last year where green transformation stocks were up 150% our basket, and we had a couple of industries like travel, industrials. You had financials. You had a massive divergence in performance. So those industries there declined a lot last year, and then before they came back. And this year again, we're seeing a huge divergence, but now just across different pockets of the market. So as you can see on slide two on the accompanying slide deck, you have green transformation, as you rightly said, down 13% this year. So it has given it back some of those gains from last year. And it sits next to next generation medicine, which is the frontier of the biotechnology industry, which in itself is a very, very high risk area of the market, and the bubble stocks. And it's all those clusters I think is linked together because it's the same type of investors that are buying these things. So you have on slide two as well, we have the bubble stocks basket scaled or created with a ratio against the MSCI World Quality Index. And you can see we're down 40% on a relative performance. That's a massive rotation out of bubble stocks, which, by the way, mimics the ARK Invest, ARK Innovation ETF, one for one, just with a higher beta. So I think the same type of investors that are buying Cathie Wood's Disruptive Innovation Fund is also the same type of investors that are betting heavily on green transformation. So it's all linked together, and we're seeing an unraveling of this. And I think just before coming back to some of your comments, John, I mean, I think that Dudley opinion piece yesterday where he basically backed up Janet Yellen's recent comments about that interest rates right now are not reflecting potentially what lies ahead of us. And that is, more high sustained inflation, and there will be an upward pressure on interest rates, and that will spook market at one point.
Yeah, but
that's not already.
Yeah, but that's the funny thing, because you mentioned that. We pulled that comment into the podcast this morning, a 4.5% Fed funds rate. I mean, the irony of this being a lot of this is happening when the market has just unwound some of the Fed expectations because of that weak April jobs report, which actually, if you look at a number of other jobs indicators recently, it's not seeing any corroboration across that. If anything, we're seeing signs of an even negative unemployment in some spaces where they're having a hard time filling positions. But that issue aside, I think the key thing is here is putting this in perspective like you have already, and then looking at, where's this headed? What are the economics? What are the earnings profiles of all, as we've all seen so many people rushing into the space? In so many cases, there are companies that are almost just an idea on paper, and in most extreme cases, other ones that have had operations for years and have not shown much profit, maybe not even ever shown a profit, and others that are valued at multiples that suggest you're already discounting multiple decades of growth. And I like this chart you brought in on slide three as well, just comparing where green energy is versus traditional black energy. What are you using as your black energy metric?
So that's the MSCI World Energy Index, which basically is heavily concentrated in oil and gas stocks.
The oil majors and
yes,
gas. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. And so maybe this is a bad analogy, but the way I see the green energy is that back in leading into 2007, just before the financial crisis, there was a lot of speculation in solar companies as well at that point in time, and a lot of talks about green technology. I think that's almost comparable to where the computer industry was in the 1980s. A lot of names back then are not here any longer. And then, you know, the recent speculative hype, I see very much the green transformation, sort of where we were back in 1995 with Windows 95 launch and the beginnings of the internet. I think we have multiple decades ahead of us in terms of the green transformation, because simply it is being decided by the political class that that's the way we're going in this society. So it will happen, but there will be a lot of bumps on the way. And I don't portray that I have any predictive power in telling you, our clients, what companies will survive and flourish. All I can say is that the majority of the companies within this theme basket are not profitable. They still rely heavily on government subsidies, and there will be a long way before we can actually crystallize and see who will be the winners. So I think if you invest in this theme, I think you're right at the trajectory, but it would be very difficult, and you have to spread your investments across a lot of different names.
And what we see in cycles like this, it goes back to the 19th century, which was actually the first great accumulation and creation of capital markets. That was the build out of railroads. Yeah. There are legions of investors scattered all across the century that lost their shirts in railroads, and yet railroads got built out aggressively to completely transform society.
Yeah,
there's that one. And then there was the internet backbone type stocks, the real hardware build out stocks in the tech and telecom bubble. That capital was needed to rush into the space to build out these incredible networks that we've created. And a lot of people lost their shirts in that round. We're not saying that everyone's going to lose their shirts. It's just to indicate it's not about predicting the failure of green energy. It's just about differentiating returns and assets versus the implications for the ongoing transformation.
Yeah.
And then pulling into the discussion, out the part and parcel of the pandemic response was a massive splash of stimulus and response, both from central banks, but also on the fiscal side, that just supercharged speculative energy of all stripes. So engineered a record comeback from a record pace of sell-off in some cases in the immediate March sort of panic response to what was unfolding last year. And, you know, these green stocks, green transformation stocks, or actually you've differentiated by calling income, basically anything that was high multiple, whether it's speculative or the internet giants, came back the strongest from the pandemic lows. And then you're indicating something so humdrum as steelmakers. I think that could be sending a signal. You've pulled in this chart before on the podcast, so I think we ought to talk about what signal that may be sending about value versus growth, et cetera.
I think in its simplest form, I think this chart on slide four really hammers in the point that I think we've hit a physical constraint in our global economy much faster than what we anticipated. I think that's the key. I think it's the key thought here because I talk to clients a lot about this. So the last 15 years, the price signal in the market was that if you want to become rich, you invest in digital companies. And it diverted a lot of capital away from the physical world. And we have a huge infrastructure gap. We have a huge gap in terms of investments in oil and gas companies, mining companies. And now we have these big ambitions on the green transformation, and that will drive a tremendous amount of extra demand for physical resources. Not only steel, which also drives demand for coal, but it's also a basic oil and gas, which is still the primary energy resource we have. It's all type of metals. It's nickel, it's copper for electric vehicles, lithium, etc. And I just think it's so puzzling that going back 6 months ago, we were talking about you have to be invested in e-commerce, you have to be invested in digitalization, and now we actually have something in the actual physical world running faster. And that's where the momentum is. The momentum in the market has shifted away from all the digital pockets, high growth pockets of the market, to financials and energy, basically.
And
materials.
Yeah, and a very big response there in steelmaking. We've seen some crazy moves in a lot of commodities markets, especially metals, driven out there in China.
And maybe we should just quickly say as well, so this response that we're seeing in the physical commodity prices and steelmaker is potentially also a canary in the coal mine for the green transformation stocks, because as we have said repeatedly, so companies in the digital world, they can expand and scale with very low marginal costs. When you're in the physical world and want to build power plants and airports and, you know, massive solar plants, it requires a lot of physical resource and capital. Mm. And if those capital prices, so if interest rates are going higher because of, you know, inflation, then your financing costs go up. But if steel prices are also going higher, like Vestas said the other day, they have to raise prices on wind turbines, and that makes it less economically viable. So it's a big conundrum.
And also with the correction we've seen today, I have no idea of whether this is going to continue, but I think there's a risk that it could. You're seeing a somewhat positive, or at least a non-correlation in the sell-off we're seeing broadly in risk sentiment, while the long end of the U.S. yield curve, for example, is seeing yields actually quite stable to going higher here in the last couple of sessions. A very unusual set of circumstances. And yes, so these projects are going to have to pay for themselves, and the inputs are suddenly going up in cost. Now, you've got a very, very long-term perspective, long-term chart here on the following slide, slide five, talking about this whole value versus growth, where we've seen legions of value investors, you know, closing up shop essentially because their whole business model has gone out of style. I think that's actually quite a large contributor to that. In my personal view, I think passive investing has also destroyed their business model. But we've seen a comeback here. How long has this comeback been going on? And what do you see something bigger, longer term potentially developing here? And what would that be linked to?
Yeah, so first of all, on slide five, what you're seeing here is that the MSCI World Value Total Return Index versus growth. So value being companies that are, you know, priced at low valuation multiples against book value, earnings per shares, and the growth companies often defined, you know, the price to earnings per share or growth expectations in the analyst estimates, etc. But you can go on there, you can search for these indices and find the methodology behind them and how they are constructed. I would say from this slide five, so what we're currently witnessing is an 18% rebound in relative performance total return wise between value stocks and growth stocks globally. And I looked, and pardon all the fancy colors, it looked like a children's drawing here, but
that's Bloomberg's pre-selected colors, just in your defense.
Thank you very much. So what I looked at here is, so how far do we have to go back to find a rebound of this magnitude from a recent low? And the interesting thing is you have to go back all the way to the early 2000s when you had that massive comeback for value stocks, which for a couple of years were almost killing AQR and Cliff Asness, which is probably the most profound and famous proponent of the value investment and systemized it to the institutional world. And then we basically begun the massive value run-up from, you know, early 2000s. And all the way back into before the financial crisis. Then we have been, as you said, in a downward trend ever since. And then, as you can see in the latter part of the or in the late part of the chart, the 2020 was a brutal year for value. And now we're just seeing the rotation coming back big time. And it's a big if, but if Dudley is just remotely right about the Fed funds rate, it will be the biggest driver of value stocks, and we'll see this rotation being incredibly big because it will prop up financial companies, it will divert resources into you know the more normal type of stocks, and the discount rate will be so high that all the growth stocks, even though they're still growth, will have to be valued at much less market valuation.
Not to mention those types of companies, a lot of them growing quite nicely, but ones that are valued at such an incredible multiple on cash flows, thinking about things like Adobe, we've talked about these before, we're just 17, 18 times sales, and they're priced almost like a bond because it's the company's effectively the equity is effectively a bond with a coupon that keeps growing slightly every year, you could argue.
Yeah.
And yes, that higher discount rate would really change the structure of forward discounting and the, you know, change the equation there.
Which is actually the topic of the next slide, actually. The whole discount rate.
The whole discount rate. And we brought this up as a theme, but take us through what you want to communicate here.
Yeah. So on slide six, I basically show that the bond type pricing we have seen in technology stocks is basically what is represented by this spread, as I call it, between the free cash flow yield of NASDAQ 100 and then the yield to worst on global corporate investment grade bonds. That's the green line right there on the chart to the left on slide six. The spread between those two lines is what you see on the right, and it has just collapsed for each year since the great financial crisis. And we are distribution-wise in the far right end of that distribution, and there is tight correlation. It makes sense. So if Dudley is right and we are right about our inflation call, and we suddenly see a 100-200 basis point move in the risk-free rate, that will channel directly into alternatives for equities, which is investment grade bonds, and that will have to create a repricing of NASDAQ 100. So even though you could still have a scenario where Microsoft or whatever other company grows revenue by 10-15% again, just the mere fact that the discount rate almost doubles in percentage points terms, that will just take the valuation down. And that could be very confusing for a lot of private investors, because why would a company that's still growing and increasing its profitability, why is that worth less? But so I can really encourage people to really think hard about this, that if you have a lot of exposure to NASDAQ 100, you're basically betting, and that's, I'm going back to Cathie Wood, the founder of ARK Invest. She has said it herself. The whole premise of growth investing in her company is based on the thesis that the demographics, the debt load, and especially the technology transition we're seeing right now is so deflationary that we'll have so ultra low interest rates and thereby also discount rate that it will favor growth investing over value investing for decades to come.
The problem is we have an extremely leveraged society, and we have a problem with inequality, and that the fiscal dominance that is taking over is going to guarantee that inflation erodes. that has to erode the real level of that debt over time.
Yeah.
So at some level, that deflation simply cannot occur unless you're going to tell me that the U.S. is going to default on its debt, and that we'll have widespread defaults and debt destruction by that route. That's not how governments do things. Now, look through history, it just doesn't happen that way. And then I think, ironically, just as we're talking through all of this, it just reminds me a recent point that Altea, our fixed income strategist, made, that, I mean, we've had such a strong backstop from central banks, from the fiscal authority, on that every little blip is going to be, they're going to swoop in and rescue us from every little correction. I think there's a policy risk in that we may be realizing to some degree, because the speculation gets so frantic in some areas that it just bubbles. At least in some areas, it gets created no matter what. But we are at remarkable extremes, looping back to Altea's point, in the premium for junk, the spread is the narrowest it's basically ever been for junk versus investment grade. And that at least stretching back to 2007, so prior to the Great Recession. So we're about as, financial stability conditions and those terms, credit conditions, have not ever been better. And there's a risk from that point as well, from any kind of credit spreads waking up. Now, before we close out the conversation, I alluded to it a little bit at the top of the podcast. To me, I was much more into the equity space back in 2000 and slightly before, and looking at how that whole arc of the, it was an incredible market, of course, at the time with the great tech telecom bubble. But how the broader market and the whole rollover happened from that peak all the way into the market low. And it was a profound market low in 2002. So first you had the hottest stuff, the dot-coms that started petering out right around the 2000 switch, end of 99, very beginning of 2000. And then it was the broader tech and networking and other stocks around March. And recall, the economy was white hot. The economy didn't actually start to lurch into a recession until 2000. And one, there was a second top. There was actually negative correlation between what might just call the average stock versus the bubble stock during much of 2000. So the S&P 500 almost managed a second peak, despite being weighed down by a lot of these big companies in September. Whereas the equal weight, so the median stock, didn't average out, and that's the S&P 500. That didn't top out until May of 2001, actually in a recession, and then. Look at something like small cap value. It actually, small cap was popular, but small cap value in particular, May 2002. And it wasn't finally until then that simply everything deleveraged and went down. And that was the only proper total bear market that lasted only until around July to the sort of late or early fall timeframe of 2002. So that's just to give an idea of the time scale. And so you have a full 2+ years of this rolling over. I wonder do you think there's a fair parallel? History doesn't repeat, but it often does rhyme And the sort of the very extreme bubble stocks could be that version of the dot-com this time around. And we can expect a lot of different rotation through different themes and sectors in the coming 18, 20, 24 months.
I think there's a lot of similarities, except that the starting point in terms of interest rate level is much different. And I think the recession risk and the incoming recession was much closer in time to that, that turning point in the market cycle, where I think this time around, I said that to you as well. I think that the irony of all this stimulus pushing up commodity price and interest rate, that it will set in motion its own demise and the recession. But judging from the strength of corporations and household budgets right now, I think it's an early 2023 scenario if it happens, and maybe already being could be priced in already in late 2022. So for now, I think that what we could experience if we suddenly get this jolt in the interest rate market, that you have all these speculative parts of the market, all the growth pockets will falter, and the rest of the market will actually continue to push higher and create that divergence. And unluckily, and that's something I'll be watching with nervousness, but also a little bit of excitement, because it's always fascinating how you know people are changing under these changing environments and markets. But we know that what happened post the 2000 dot-com bubble is that it sucked out a lot of private investors, and especially young people that have been engaged in the market. And we're seeing the same patterns today with a lot of young people that have engaged in trading cryptos and these growth pockets, buying the dip all the time. And we could potentially find ourselves in a new period over the coming 5 years where a lot of these new retail investors are pulling out of the market again, spooked by a 40% relative drop in bubble stocks versus quality. That hurts.
Yeah, because actually, parallel to the previous experience, everybody was in the tech stocks back then.
Yes,
they were not in Dow stocks. They were in tech and the tech moves and in tech funds, etc. And it is a very fair point, of course, about the differences. I wonder if the policy mistake this time could be that they have to come in, as Dudley indicates, that they realize that they've over yeasted the cake, if pretending I'm a baker, and with this guarantee to keep rates at zero, and then they have to come in too late with the interest rate hikes to deal with the inflationary pressures. Whereas last time, as you point out, a very different environment. I think we were at 6% Fed funds rate, and there was 500 basis points of cuts that unfolded from there, starting in early 2001. And if memory serves, lasting all the way until early 2004.
Yeah. But that's also what's fascinating about when you wind back time and look at what happened back then, because you had these bubble stocks, dot-com stocks, that were trading even at negative implied equity risk premiums. So there was no premium whatsoever on a 10-year horizon against treasuries, which was basically a risk-free trade. And the reason why we have all these bubble stocks and green transformation being propped up is because the alternative, I saw these return expectations in Europe, and the expectation is that if you hold a portfolio combination of mortgage bonds in Europe and government bonds, you will have a negative real rate return for 10 years.
Yes. So. Yeah, and the spectacular investment that time would have been to go along the longest end of the U.S. Treasury yield curve. Now to realize decent returns there, you have to talk about deeply negative 10-year or deeply negative 30-year rates. It's a non-starter when we've transitioned to fiscal dominance. So I think that is the scary sort of, the sort of across the board perspective for somebody that's looking to extract yield out of this market.
I think that's a wrap. Right?
I think, I think we've run out of things to entertain you with for this podcast. We'll be back tomorrow with a special podcast. I'm hoping if I get it recorded, it's not recorded, it's not in the bag yet, but discussing especially inflation and inflation scenarios from here with our CIO, Stijn Jakobsen.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.